Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we're speaking from Srimad Bhagavatam, the first canto, third chapter, text 2. Somebody mercifully gave me the 10th canto. Does someone have a first canto? Thank you. All right. Do I have to pay you Lakshmi for this book? Is that because you're a book distributor? Okay. So, text 2, please repeat after me. Yasyam basi shayanasya yoga nidram vitanvataha nabhi gadham bhujad asid brahma vishvasrijam patihi yasyam basi shayanasya yoga nidram vitanvataha nabhi radham bhujad asid brahma vishvasrijam patihi yasyam bhasi shayanasya yoga nidram vitanvataha Nabhiradham bhujad asid Brahma vishvasrijam patihi Prabhus? Yasyam bhasi shayanasya Yoga nidram vitanvataha Nabhi hridam bhujad asid Brahma vishvasrijam patihi Yasyam bhasi shayanasya Yoga nidram vitanvataha Nabhi hridam bhujad asid Brahma Vishvasrijam Patihi Yasyam Bhasi Shayanasya Yoga Nidram Vatan Vataha Nabhiradam Bhujad Asid Brahma Vishvasrijam Patihi Yasyam bhasi shayanasya Yoga nidram vitanvataha Nabhi hradam bhujad asid Brahma vishvasrijam patihi Matajis Yasyam bhasi shayanasya Yoga nidram vatan vataha Nabhiradam bhujad asid Brahma vishvasrijam patihi Word meanings Yasya Whose Ambhasi In the water Shayanasya Lying down Yoga nidram, sleeping in meditation. Vitanvataha, ministering. Nabhi, navel. Radha, out of the lake. Ambujat, from the lotus. Asit, was manifested. Brahma, the grandfather of the living beings. Vishva, the universe. Srijam, the engineers. Patihi, master. Translation. A part of the Purusha lies down within the water of the universe. From the navel lake of his body sprouts a lotus stem. And from the lotus flower atop this stem, Brahma, the master of all engineers in the universe, becomes manifest. Please repeat after me. A part of the Purusha lies down within the water of the universe. From the navel lake of his body sprouts a lotus stem. And from the lotus flower atop this stem, Brahma, the master of all engineers in the universe, becomes manifest. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The first Purusha is the Karadadakashayi Vishnu. From his skin holes, innumerable universes have sprung up. In each and every universe, the Purusha enters as the Garbhadakashayi Vishnu. He is lying within the half of the universe which is full with the water of his body. And from the navel of Garbhadakashayi Vishnu has sprung the stem of the lotus flower, the birthplace of Brahma, who is the father of all living beings and the master of all the demigod engineers engaged in the perfect design and working of the universal order. Within the stem of the lotus, there are 14 divisions of planetary systems, and the earthly planets are situated in the middle. Upwards, there are other better planetary systems, and the topmost system is called Brahma Loka or Satya Loka. Downwards from the earthly planetary systems, there are 7 lower planetary systems, and inhabited by the Asuras and similar other materialistic living beings. From Garbhadakashayi Vishnu, there's an expansion of the Kshiradakashayi Vishnu, who is the collective Paramatma of all living beings. He is called Hari, and from him, all incarnations within the universe are expanded. Therefore, the conclusion is that the Purusha avatar is manifested in 3 features. First, the Karadadakashayi, who creates aggregate material ingredients in the Mahatattva. Second, the Garbhadakashayi, who enters in each and every universe. And third, the Kshiradakashayi Vishnu, who is the Paramatma and each and every object, organic and or inorganic. One who knows these plenary features of the personality of Godhead knows Godhead properly, and thus the knower becomes freed from the material conditions of birth, death, old age, and disease, as it is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. In this shloka, the subject matter of Mahavishnu is summarized. The Mahavishnu lies down in some part of the spiritual sky by his own free will. Thus he lies on the ocean of Karana, from where he glances over his material nature, and the Mahatattva is at once created. Thus electrified by the power of the Lord, the material nature at once creates innumerable universes, just as in due course a tree decorates itself with innumerable grown fruits. The seed of the tree is sown by the cultivator, and the tree, or creeper, in due course becomes manifested with so many fruits. Nothing can take place without a cause. The Karana ocean is therefore called the causal ocean. Karana means causal. We should not foolishly accept the atheistic theory of creation. The description of atheists, of the atheists, is given in the Bhagavad Gita. The atheist does not believe in the creator, but he cannot give a good theory to explain the creation. Material nature has no power to create without the power of the Purusha, just as a Prakriti or woman cannot produce a child without the connection of a Purusha or man. The Purusha impregnates and the Prakriti delivers. We should not expect milk from the fleshy bags of the neck of a goat, although they look like breastly nipples. Similarly, we should not expect any creative power from the material ingredients. We must believe in the power of the Purusha who impregnates Prakriti or nature. Because the Lord wishes to lie down in meditation, the material energy created innumerable universes at once, and each of them the Lord lay down, and thus all the planets and the different paraphernalia were created at once by the will of the Lord. The Lord has unlimited potencies, and thus he can act as he likes by perfect planning. Although personally he has nothing to do, no one is greater than or equal to him. That is the verdict of the Vedas. Om Agyanti Medandhasa Garanjana Shalakaya Chakshudun Militam Yenatasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Sri Gudo Sri Utapadakamalam Sri Gudun Vaishnavam Shcha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahaganaraganatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Pratitana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitam Shcha Hey Krishna Kuduna Sandho Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Tanta Namostite Tapta Kanchana Godangi Dadhe Vrindavaneshwari Mrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpadadubhyascha Kripasandhubhyayevacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktavarinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So we see, before the appearance of Krishna, the demigods and demons were engaged in a tremendous battle, right, throughout the galaxy. And the demons were being destroyed, and therefore they began to take birth on the earth. Mother Bhumi, she was greatly disturbed by this. So there's actually, Prabhupada mentions in that section of the Krishna book, there's a certain standard process by which what demigods do whenever there's trouble, is they go to Lord Brahma. And then Lord Brahma takes them to Kshiradakshaya Vishnu, as mentioned in this verse, lying in the milk ocean. And they go to the shore. They can't see him, but they begin offering prayers. They actually pray the Purusha Sukta. Prabhupada mentions there that's the standard prayer that they offer to the Supreme Lord. So here we see in this verse, the Purusha, these verses, this beginning of this chapter, the Purusha is being discussed. So who is this Purusha? It's very interesting because Prabhupada mentions that it's really only one Purusha. There's one deity and he's manifest in three forms. You know, it's Karanadakshaya Vishnu, Gabadakshaya Vishnu, and Kshiradakshaya Vishnu. And he does many different things, primarily concerned with the material nature. And one of those, of course, is to maintain and to make sure that dharma, samstapanartaya sambhavama yuge yuge, that dharma is manifest in the universe. So the demigods, they go to him and they offer these prayers. And it's amazing because, you know, it's implied sort of that he may appear before him. But this time he didn't, right? Nothing happened. They offered their prayers. Purusham evedigam sarvam yachcha bhavyam. You know, they're offering these prayers, which are very beautiful as a description of the Supreme Lord. Sahasra shisha purushaha sahasraksha sahasrapat. Right? It's just like in the Bhagavad Gita with the, he's got thousands of eyes and thousands of heads, like the Virat Rupa. And Purusham evedigam sarvam, you know, everything is him. Everything is the Purusha. These three Vishnus, everything is him. Everything you see, yachcha bhavyam, everything now, everything in the past, everything in the future, whatever can or will exist, is him. Everything is his energy. We jivas, aparyam itam, prakritam jiva, prakritam vidime param, we're the supreme prakriti, we're the higher prakriti. Bhumir apanalo vayu kammana buddhi devacha. And this whole material existence we see is nothing but his inferior energy, his separated energy. Right now, all of us, we're basically floating within the energy of Vishnu. We ourselves are part of that energy, right? And Prabhupada mentions in this purport that this Purusha incarnation, this Supreme Lord is the Supersoul, he enters into everything that is both living and non-living, right? He's saturating everything. He's within our heart as the Supersoul. It's considered to be the size of a thumb. You can take your thumb, stick it right here, right? That's the size of the Supersoul. So, but he's also within every single atom. The Supersoul manifests. Isn't that incredible? So he saturates the entire universe with himself. And the universe is nothing but his energies. And on top of it all, the universe is floating within his effulgence. It's floating within his Brahma Jyoti. It's mentioned here that he finds, you know, within this effulgence of the spiritual world, in Tribhad Vibhuti, he finds this one little part and he lies down and immediately all the universes begin expanding from him. Right? So, this is the Purusha. And so when they're offering these prayers, he may appear before them, but you know, sometimes he doesn't. He'll just appear and he won't appear at all. And then Lord Brahma, as mentioned in the Krishna book, he actually sits down in meditation, you know, and he begins meditating on Vishnu. After the demigods have offered all these prayers and glorified Vishnu, he begins meditating. And then, just as in the beginning of creation, then he actually hears, you know, Vishnu begins speaking to him and giving him instructions. In fact, this time around, he told Brahma, tell the demigods, take birth in the family of the Yadu dynasty, right, with all their wives. And then he himself is going to appear. And he's going to appear not alone. He never appears alone. He's always with his associates and potencies. So he's going to appear with Maya Devi and with Anantashesh, Lord Balaram and Subhadra, right? Or Lord Balaram and Maya Devi. So you see that Krishna, he always appears with his entire retinue within this material universe. And he appears to protect the demigods and to protect the saintly persons and to annihilate the miscreants, right? In fact, Prabhupada mentions this point. Actually, I wanted to read this beautiful quote from the Bhagavad Gita. The avatar or incarnation of Godhead descends from the kingdom of God for material manifestation. And the particular form of the personality of Godhead who descends is called an incarnation or avatar. Such incarnations are situated in the spiritual world, the kingdom of God. When they descend to the material creation, they assume the name avatar. There are various kinds of avatars, such as Purusha avatars, Guna avatars, Lila avatars, Shaktivesha avatars, Manvantara avatars, Yuga avatars, all appearing on schedule all over the universe. But Lord Krishna is the primeval Lord, the fountainhead of all avatars. Lord Sri Krishna descends for the specific purpose of mitigating the anxieties of the pure devotees, who are very anxious to see him in his original Vrindavan pastimes. Therefore, the prime purpose of the Krishna avatar is to satisfy his unalloyed devotees. So we see that Krishna descends, just like it's mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, like the waves of the ocean. Continually, Krishna is manifesting himself. And as Prabhupada mentions, that you have in the spiritual world, all the spiritual planets, the different incarnations or expansions of Krishna are there, and yet they all manifest through the Supersoul. Right? Through Kshitadakashayi Vishnu, they manifest into the world. Except Krishna is Svayam Bhagavan. He's the original source. Right? So he's in a special position. And when Krishna descends, he's not coming specifically just to, you know, Dharma Samstarpanataya Sambhavam Yogeva. He's not descending just to give Dharma or to protect the pious and to annihilate the miscreants. He has another purpose, which is, as Prabhupada says here, mitigate the anxiety of the pure devotees. Right? The devotees are absorbed in Krishna 24 hours a day, and they're talking about Krishna, glorifying Krishna, preaching about Krishna, and therefore they have a yearning for Krishna. So Krishna comes to satisfy that yearning. He comes to meet them in meet them halfway in their devotion, right? He's basically answering the call of the devotees, just like during the Jagannath Rath Yatra, Lord Jagannath comes out of the temple to see his devotees. Yeah. So similarly, Krishna, he comes out of the spiritual world to come here. It's a very beautiful thing. And so, and by doing so, he actually gives us many different pastimes to meditate on. He gives us something to think about. He gives us essentially his association. And by meditating on that and understanding it through in the proper way, right? Janma karma chime divyam evam yo veti tatvataha. By understanding the truth of his birth and appearance, then you never longer take birth in the material world again. So Krishna is so amazing that just by him coming, he fills the whole universe with his glories, right? It's just like, for example, I don't know, you know, in Dudwarka, it's kind of a mundane example, but maybe there was like a rock star or something like that visited the temple many years ago. People still talk about it, you know. Steven Tyler visited Govinda's, you know, we still remember, right? Or something. So, you know, it's like when a famous or powerful person goes somewhere, their glories continue to stay in that place. So Krishna, he's constantly coming to the material world and filling it with his light, filling it with his glories. And people are talking about him for thousands upon thousands of years after he leaves. Right? And not only that, but the power of discussing when he comes and what he did when he was here is so great that just by meditating on it, it takes you out of material existence entirely. You don't have to practice pranayama. You don't have to do asanas or mudras and all these things. All you have to do is chant and glorify him, and he's so powerful that he awakens you as a soul. and your entire material existence gradually becomes purified and then melts entirely, right? And falls from you, and your conditioned existence is gone. And you're left as a pure soul in Krishna Prema just by contacting Krishna. That's how incredible he is. Ramadi Murtishu Kalani Mena Tishtan Nanavatadamakadod Bhuvaneshukintu Krishna Swayam Samabhavat Paraman Pumanyo Govindamadi Buddhisham Tamaham Bhajami. So Ramadi Murtishu, so Lord Ram, beginning, right? And all the other incarnations, such as Nrsinga and Varaha and Vamanadev, Kalani Mena Tishtan, they're all manifestations of Krishna. They're all his expansions, yeah? But Krishna Swayam Samabhavat Paramapumanyo. Krishna is the original incarnation. You're dealing with, when you see Rukmini Dwarkadish, you're dealing with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the highest manifestation of Krishna. And in the age of Kali, he actually descends himself. He gives his highest mercy and allows us access to his pastimes. Isn't that incredible? You know, not only is it, we're fortunate to even hear the name of Lord Ram or the name of Varaha, but I mean that alone is unimaginable mercy upon this conditioned soul locked tightly and wallowing in the darkness of ignorance. And yet, in the age of Kali, due to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy, Krishna himself is actually manifesting and giving us entrance into his pastimes. So it's an incredible thing. But we see that Krishna, you know, the Supersoul manifests, you know, through the Supersoul, the various incarnations of Krishna manifest, such as Lord Ram, as we mentioned, Ramadi Murtishu. Today is, of course, Ram Vijayotsava, which is the day when Ravan was destroyed. And who is Ravan? Well, if we look at ourselves, we might find an indication. he's the archetypical demon obsessed with enjoying the material world separate from Krishna. He sees the world not as Krishna's energy, as we're mentioning. You know, everything is Krishna's energy. We're the higher Prakriti, there's the lower Prakriti, there's the Supersoul manifest in all different levels of reality, both in the living and non-living, right? And yet, you know, the tendency of the conditioned soul is we don't see that. We block out Krishna. We don't want to see Krishna. We want to forget Krishna, and we want to drool over his material energy. We want to, salivating. Right? We're obsessed with trying to enjoy and gratify ourselves with Maya, with matter. And that was Ravan's mentality. He's very lascivious. He was looking towards Mother Sita as the object of his enjoyment. Right? He's essentially looking at Krishna's energy, his Shakti, as something for him. And this is within all of us, isn't it? I mean, all of us experience, of course, many senior devotees here, please forgive me, but the tendency of us, at least myself, is that we look at the material world with the desire to enjoy, with a very intense lust to gratify ourselves. That's like Ravan. And yet Ram is so powerful. And in this particular incarnation, he was slaying the Rakshasas, slaying them by the millions. And then Ravan himself, he shot right into his heart, you know, and burst that nectar, right, and destroyed Ravana. So similarly, if we chant the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. We meditate on the vibration, Ram, Ram, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. And we try to hear Ram. That also bursts that vial of poisonous nectar in our heart, right? We look at it and if we look at our consciousness, we'll see that, you know, yeah, there's some Krishna consciousness there, but there's a whole lot of Ravana. You know, there's a whole lot of Ravana, a whole lot of lust and desire to enjoy the world. And sometimes it seems like we can never defeat it. How can we even come up against this power? It's so great, this lust that's on top of us, this demon on our shoulders, right? Crushing us and burying us, pulling us down in our spiritual life. This monster, this ten-headed monster, Dasha Griva. How can we overcome him? It's very difficult, right? It's impossible. But, daivyesha gunamaya mama maya dadaktya, if we surrender to Krishna, if we just take shelter of the name of Ram, then very quickly that demon screams. He's completely destroyed just by the power of Lord Ram's name. Right? All we have to do is take shelter of that. Prabhupada mentions, I'll read another quote here. This is from the Bhagavad Gita. No, actually, this is from a lecture. He can manifest himself anywhere and everywhere, and wherever he desires to appear in each and every incarnation. This is Bhagavad Gita. He speaks as much about religion as can be understood by the particular people under their particular circumstances. But the mission is the same, to lead people to God consciousness and obedience to the principles of religion. Sometimes he descends personally, and sometimes he sends his bona fide representative in the form of his son, or servant, or himself in some disguised form. So as we heard Drutakarma Prabhu was mentioning a few days ago, that he appears even in all the different species, 8,400,000 species of life, there's incarnations of Krishna, right? And so, but generally you'll see that he's coming to establish religious principles and to raise up society. And therefore, you'll see that his servants will come, his sons will come, which is obviously a reference to Jesus, right? So his sons will come, and his servants, and those who are empowered by him, whenever Dharma is at its weakest point, he'll reinvigorate it by the presence of those individuals, such as Srila Prabhupada. I mean, I wasn't alive in the 1960s, but from what it appears to me, that in the 1960s, it's almost like the principles of religion just sort of fell out of society, like the bottom just fell out, whatever was there, right? Illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, that just like went through the roof and became normalized. And you see, Srila Prabhupada came at precisely that moment. It's amazing. So we see that, and there's always, you know, whenever these acharyas and these great personalities come, they're always challenging the common materialistic ideas, right? The predominant ideas that spread like a disease from the leaders of society, right? The Ravana-like leaders, they preach and they have their own vision of how things should be. Ravana felt that he was God, you know, that he should be worshipped, that he's the most powerful, the most handsome, the most qualified. Everyone should bow down to him and gratify him. And he convinced, you know, all of his followers, all the Rakshasas, to see this way. And so similarly, you have the demons in modern society and even ancient society who they have their own vision and they oppress society with that vision and destroy the religious principles in that society. And so one particular servant of Krishna who came to challenge that was Madhvacharya. And today also is the day we celebrate Madhvacharya. And we see that he was actually, just like the demigods who were asked to come by Krishna, he was himself a manifestation of Vayu, right? And he was extremely powerful. In fact, there's many wonderful pastimes due to limited time, obviously. We can't indulge them all. But in honor of Shishi Rukmini Dwarkadish, we'll tell one, is that in Dwarka, you know, we have our tilak, right? Many of you, of course, have heard this story. But in Dwarka, they have the, you know, we buy tilak, it comes in little piece like this big. So in Dwarka, they have giant chunks of this stuff, big chunks of clay. They pull it out of the ground. And where it comes from, in fact, all of you probably have it on your forehead right now, is that the queens of Dwarka used to bathe in these different kuns. And so the clay that they mushed their lotus feet into, that's actually coming today to us as Dwarka tilak clay. Isn't that incredible? As Gopi Chandan. I mean, how many of you have been in India, you've swam in a kunda, or a pukar, whatever they're called, and you know, it's kind of gross, but your feet squish in the mud and stuff, you know, and there's all sorts of weird hard things that, you know, you're hoping it's not something bad. There's all sorts of weird stuff in it, but you're squishing your feet into it, yeah? So that's what the queens of Dwarka did. They were regular squishing their feet into this, and so now we're wearing it on our forehead. Isn't that amazing? That's the mercy of Krishna. And so, there was a merchant ship that was coming from Dwarka, and they had a big giant chunk of tilak. They were using it as ballast in the ship. You know, you put it kind of like in the middle rear of the ship, and it keeps it sort of the center of gravity so the ship doesn't rock too much. So there's this giant chunk of Gopi Chandan. But it wasn't working because they're caught up in a storm, a horrible storm off the eastern coast of India. And the ship was going back and forth and it was going to be torn apart, washed up against a sandbar, broken against the rocks, right? But Madhvacharya happened to be sitting there on the bank of the ocean, and he was, or on the shore of the ocean, he was meditating, and he saw this ship, and then somehow or other he guided the ship from the shore and saved the ship. you know, guided them away from the sandbars and everything. And so after the storm, the captain was so grateful that he came with all of his associate servants, and they came and paid obeisances to this great sannyasi. And they asked him, you know, how can we reciprocate? What can we give you? And so, you know, they showed him all the wares of the ship. Is there anything you want in our ship? Jewels and herbs and incense and all these different things. And he wasn't interested. But then when they went to the core of the ship and he saw this big chunk of Gopi Chanda, and he's thinking, okay, you know, I'll use that, right? All the devotees, we can use this tilak. So he said he'll take it. So it was a humongous, you know, we're talking like this big. And so it was very, very heavy. But somehow or other, he was able to carry it. In fact, Prabhupada mentions this pastime in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. He says 30 people tried to carry it, but they couldn't. So, but anyway, he was so powerful, he actually took this tilak on his shoulder, and he was walking with it, and all his disciples are walking with him, and then the boulder on his shoulder slipped, and it fell, and it cracked, and guess what was inside? It's actually the deity of Krishna was there, Udupi Krishna. Right? I believe it's Rukmini Devi's personal deity. So this is an incredible pastime, and Udupi Krishna is still worshipped to this day. And I can't remember, what's the name of his mutt? Is it just Udupi? Huh? Shringar Mat, is it? So anyway, but you can go there today, and the deity is still being worshipped. So this is a very powerful personality, but he came essentially to push against the Mayavad philosophy. That was his mission. In fact, he's preaching dualism, right? He's actually, the Mayavadis are preaching everything is one, right? I am God. And he's coming and shattering it and challenging it, coming to the people of that time and smashing that particular philosophy. And so similarly, we see Srila Prabhupada is also smashing the materialist philosophies that he's encountered. And what's the philosophy, the ignorant materialistic philosophy, which is kind of crushing and poisoning society, with it, unleashing the ravana within society? What is that today? Well, it's modern atheistic science, as he's talking about here. This particular purport is talking about creation. Prabhupada devoted almost half of the purport to smashing these materialistic scientists. They're the Mayavadis, in a sense, that we are struggling against, right? They're the ones creating a materialistic attitude within society which is degrading everyone. Essentially, what they're telling people is that there is no purpose of life. There's no spiritual goal. There's no God. The only purpose of life is to gratify your lust, right? As mentioned in the purport, Krishna talks about this in the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, right? That the only purpose of life is anishwaram. There's no God, right? There's no soul. There's nothing spiritual. All there is the desire to reproduce. It's basically the theory of evolution, Darwin's theory of evolution. You know, the only thing, the only impetus for life, the only reason life exists is to procreate and do it better and better and better and to try to survive. And beyond that, there's no truth. There's nothing beyond that. There's no higher purpose to life. You're just an animal. You're just an animal who walks upright. Right? And due to having a large engorged brain, you develop all sorts of, you know, strange fantasies about God and all this, right? But really there's no higher purpose to life. So what's the result of this in society? You see people are wild. People have gone crazy, right? I mean, it's just they've totally thrown away any sense of dignity, any sense of religion, any sense of morality. And they're basically, you know, please excuse me for saying this, but they're basically just acting like animals. You know, like wild animals. You're like going to a zoo or something, right? Like monkeys in a cage. So this type of lifestyle, it's a waste of the human form of life. And so when Prabhupada, one of his main preaching sort of missions was to challenge this ignorant materialistic conception of life. We see in the purport, actually, he gives quite a few different points about this. First of all, he mentions that these scientists, they basically, one of his main criticisms is they're just masquerading as if they know, right? Like it's all just theory. There's nothing proven, but they pretend like they know. Like there's a certain authority. You can see that one of the main obstacles in your preaching may be that people have this idea that, you know, it's somehow, it's worshiping God or believing in God is irrational or it's illogical. Right? It's not. In other words, because the scientists have created for themselves such a sense of authority within society, they're like the gurus, right? And anything that goes against them is considered heretical or illusory or foolish or ridiculous. You know, it's like a craziness if you even go against what they say. So this sort of authority is, it's based on nothing because they have no true answers. They don't really present anything. They just present theory after theory, which is overturned and overturned and overturned. So they have none. They're actually not presenting anything. Right? There's actually nothing solid that they're saying this is the truth. They're just presenting theories, but then they have the nerve to present themselves as an unquestionable authority. So Prabhupada is challenging that and attacking that. Also, Prabhupada mentions in this particular purport that there's intelligence within creation, just like this microphone. You know, it's obvious it didn't just appear, right? And it's like we walked in for Mangalartik and it was there and everyone's shocked. Wow, you know, it just manifested from nowhere. It's happened by chance. No, there's obviously a creator. You can see there's intelligence in this. Someone had to design it. Yeah, someone took a lot of, you know, every little piece, if you just look at every little piece, it was designed by an engineer in a particular way. So that's how nature itself is, right? Like this sense of design that we can see in this object here, it actually extends to all of creation. That's something that's there in all levels of reality. And so if you truly study science, you'll actually come to that conclusion. Like if you know, in other words, if you're studying materialistic science and you come to the conclusion that there's no creator, there's no intelligence, there's no God, that's actually born of your own free will. That's your own sort of perverse, envious attitude corrupting what you're seeing. If you actually study, and it's a fact, if you read like books on biology and stuff like that, it's the, even from the modern scientific perspective, the way that life exists in human life and all life on the earth, it's actually a miracle. It's something that it exists within the tiniest window of opportunity. Like if you know, Prabhupada mentions, you know, there's intelligence in the way that the sun moves up and down, you know, every day in a regulated way, and the tide comes in and out in a regulated way. So if you look at this from a scientific perspective, that's a fact. Like if this regulation, this kind of tiny window that this planet passes through, even the temperature, like the regulation of the temperature, if we moved a little bit faster or a little bit slower, then the human life couldn't even exist. We would die due to being too cold or too hot, right? So it's like we exist in this tiny little window which is created by this extreme level of balance and harmony within nature. And so that indicates intelligence. Right, just as this machine, it's actually functioning, you know, in a very, there's like a small window in which it will function. We can see every day somebody struggles with the wire, struggles with this, struggles with that. This thing's always falling and stuff, right? It's because it's essentially, it's designed to work in a very specific way, and you have to use it in that way. So the universe is the same way. It only works in a very specific way. It's fine-tuned for life to exist. Okay? So these are some of the things that Prabhupada mentions regarding that. But the modern materialistic society, just like if someone looks at the what appears to be nipples on the neck of a goat and thinks that they're actually breasts and there's milk there. So in the same way, modern scientists believe that life itself is the source of consciousness. It's the source of the soul. So all of these ideas are foolish, and we should, you know, as servants of Srila Prabhupada, servants of Madhvacharya, servants of the Supreme Lord Vishnu, who comes personally and sends his servants and associates to establish Dharma, we also have to antagonize and preach against this materialistic worldview. We have to present the absolute truth as it is given in the Shastra, and that's powerful enough to actually overturn this materialistic illusion. Right? We shouldn't think that, maybe these scientists, I don't know if the Shastras are, you know, can we actually challenge them? No, you just present it, and you purify yourself by chanting Hare Krishna. You purify yourself by following the process, and Krishna will empower you. Just like we see, you know, devotees even here are empowered by Krishna. And so Krishna will empower you to push back, and at least, if not the scientists, then the general people in society will be turned away from that materialistic Ravan-like consciousness. Okay? Thank you very much. Are there any comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu?
Have that conception. Mm-hmm.
So some people think Vishnu is the Supreme Personality of Godhead instead of Krishna. So, there's obviously, perhaps they're not familiar with the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam, right? If you look in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's that whole chapter where in South India, you know, there's the whole discussion of that particular issue. So I would just suggest you look there. I mean, it's a long subject matter. But basically, if you read there in those purports, Prabhupada explains it. What was the second question?
Okay. The other question, you're talking about how the scientists have created an authority for themselves. Basically, mm-hmm. they're like the guru of modern civilization. So, you know, if you go to like USC or UCLA, you see this huge campus with all these professors, thousands of students. It looks impressive. So, but that it's all based on material education. So, how did they create that authority for themselves, where everyone just believes them automatically? How was that created?
Well, I would say there's a couple things going on. You know, it used to be before the Enlightenment, what's called the Enlightenment, there was that position of authority was taken by the church or churches, right? And gradually that authority was overturned, and then they kind of stepped into the position. And they've gained a lot of authority because of the production of modern technology, right? It's a byproduct of the scientific worldview. You have the Industrial Revolution, you have the Agricultural Revolution, which is just as important. And so both of these, in many ways, are based upon the steps of modern science. Now, we're not against advances in material technology. You know, we believe they can be used properly when you bring in the concept of God and using them in the service of God. But the point is that has given them a lot of authority. In other words, in the past 500 years or so, human society has advanced in technology and in population due to the agricultural revolution by leaps and bounds. And the entire modern sort of world that we live in is in many ways created by them. And so that gives a very powerful, it lends a lot of credence to their authority. You know, and then you also see within for example, in America, there's a division between church and state. And so religious teachings are no longer allowed in school, right? This is something Prabhupada also criticized, that the soul is, there's no department for what is the soul. Yeah, and so because the soul and sort of the reality, the supernatural reality, has been sort of driven out of the educational institution from the top to kindergarten, therefore they've been allowed to, in essence, present their particular perspective on reality unchallenged for generations, like 10, 15 generations, whatever it is, right? And so that also creates in society, you know, a very strong allegiance to their unquestionable authority. But people in general don't accept it, you know. Like, you'll see there's always a reaction against that. For example, in the 1800s, you have the rise of, you know, romanticism. There's always like a rebellion against people. They don't like a very intense materialistic worldview. People aren't satisfied being told that they're nothing but chemicals. And so, you know, even though they have this sort of authority in society, there's always opportunity. People are always willing to hear a higher truth. Is that okay? Okay. I think that's all we have time for. So thank you very much. All glories, Prabhupada.